We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, we're comparing the Harry Potter novels with the Netflix series Stranger Things. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, essays exploring the world of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, and I am the Director of Campus Ministry and Adjunct Faculty in Humanities at Ohio Dominican University, author of a lot of Harry Potter stuff.
Today, we are joined by our Potterversity producer, board member, and frequent presenter at the Harry Potter Academic Conference, Laurie Beckoff. So glad to have you on again, Laurie.
Thank you. I will take credit for this episode.
I love having, when Laurie has an idea for an episode, you know, we usually ask her to be on it because, you know, she usually has just a few things to say about that topic. So it kind of takes the pressure off of us, Katie. I don't know if you feel that way, but I always feel that way. So it's always happy to have you here, Laurie.
And, you know, we had a little bit of a delay because I had to finish watching it. So watching the last season. So we're all up on it. But I will say, listeners, if you have not watched Stranger Things, the last season, then we will be spoiling things potentially. So you might want to, you know, go ahead and watch it. Emily and Laurie, how did you first encounter Stranger Things? Laurie, since this was all your idea, tell us when you first watched it and what you liked about it.
So my Facebook memories were helpful in reminding me recently. I started watching it almost exactly 9 years ago in January of 2017 or February 2017. So it had already been out for maybe 6 months or so. And I think my roommate at the time had watched it, and I was kind of scared because I heard it was kind of horror, and I love sci-fi, but I am really, really scared of horror. So I foolishly watched it alone with the lights off in one weekend while my roommate was gone. And according to that Facebook post that I found in my memories, I was like, oh, this took me longer than I intended because I had to keep turning it off and turning the lights back on because I got scared. But I do remember feeling... and I think this has actually been consistent for me through every single season. I switch off between, oh, God, why am I watching this? This is way too scary for me. And like, wait, I'm so compelled. So many mysteries, so many interesting characters. I have to know more. So I think it really can suck you in, even if you're like watching from behind your hands like I do half the time.
So my husband and I will like binge a series and we'll watch things, you know, several nights in a row. He has a couch and I have a couch. So I sit on my couch and I read my book. And if things are getting rough, I just like lift the book over my face. But I, you know, but a jump scare will get me every time. And I'm yelling at the TV and stuff like that. So I definitely got hooked. But I didn't watch it so early. I think I might have started. There were four seasons already. I mean, I think that I probably got in on it real late and then had to wait for this last one to come out. But yeah. What about you, Emily?
You know, I really don't have a memory of deciding to watch it, but I have a feeling it was when maybe season two was coming out and I kind of zoomed through seasons one and two. But yeah, I also was really swept up in it pretty immediately. Just loving. I mean, there's a lot of Star Wars references in the first few episodes. And so if everything else about it didn't grab me, I was like, okay, I'm here for this because not only are there Star Wars references on the surface, but then there's also this kind of very strong Star Wars connection in the way that Eleven's powers seemed to work. So I was like, I'm here for this. I had an 80s childhood. I'm here for this. So I think it's been a fair few years.
Yeah, I was going to say like this is my time as a youth. So I'm dating myself for sure. But like I grew up in the 80s and I remember like Having a bike meant you could go places, and that, kids were just rolling around the neighborhood doing stuff and running in packs and getting into trouble, and we were pretty independent. And I remember the hairstyles. Now, I will say, I believe they could have leaned into the hairstyles more than they did, but it is hard, I think, for some female actors to be willing to go all the way with that. Very foofy. It was the one time when my hair, my natural hair, was totally in.
I was born after the 80s, but I've often thought that my hair would work well in the 80s.
Yeah,
Yeah, it would
golden.
have. It
The
totally would have
volume,
worked
I would
well.
have thrived.
Now, I
And
do
the
think,
bright colors.
yes,
Oh, the bright colors, just the
that would work for me
fashions in
too.
general, just the Gap and the mall and like, oh my gosh, it was just such a time for the,
Yeah. I think
yeah.
that the Wheeler family did the best with the haircuts. Nancy, they did a pretty good job getting Nancy all poofed up in the front, and then also her mom, and then the dad. Like, you can't find a more 80s guy than
Oh my gosh,
Ted Wheeler.
his glasses are the
Perfect.
best. See, for
Perfect.
me, my hairspiration in season one was Dustin because he was curly.
Oh.
But then, of course, Max came in season two, and I was like, my ginger. Well, I mean, we had Barb in season one, but that didn't go very well. Max came in season two, and I was like, yes, and I have cosplayed as her.
Yes,
Oh,
very good.
yeah.
I have cosplayed as 11. So I did the a bitchin' 11. So with the eye makeup and the rolled up jeans and the
Cool.
Converse and yeah.
Yeah, so I felt like this was one that I needed to watch because it was, speaking to my generation, but then, it was it kind of had that fantasy element and people were talking about it. So I think that's why I ended up with it. And then I did like it. I think for what the reasons that you said, Laurie, I liked that there were these mysteries and there were these interesting relationships. Now, I was never into D&D, but I knew people into D&D, and my kids actually now play D&D.
Stranger Things has given D&D a real moment. Kind of mainstream kids are more interested in it now because of Stranger Things.
And it, but D&D has always kind of gone in these little cyclical waves, and it had a good combination of like humor and teen angst and the horrors of what the world is really like that sucked me in.
We also have to say the music from day
Yes.
one, the music has, if
Love it.
like, both like the 80s songs that we all know, but also the
The
score with
score.
that synth and everything. Like, it's amazing music. While like gearing up for season five, I did listen to the hours long Stranger Things playlist. Yeah, the music really sets the tone. I feel like there's just a vibe that you really
Yeah.
get watching Stranger Things that pulls you in. And the music is a
Yeah.
huge part of that.
And I did
Definitely.
also like the various 80s historical references, and because the Cold War, like it was a whole thing, and it wasn't too long after I was teaching college when I could see the generational break. Like, nobody even knew what the Cold War was anymore. My students think the Cold War and World War II are the same thing, So, just
Oh boy.
All right, what did you all think of the last season and the end of the series? What were your thoughts on that? Did it live up to what you wanted?
Well, I'm sad it's over. But I thought it was a good ending. And the characters are getting all grown up. So I can see that I like it when things do come to a completion and don't just roll on and on and on. I thought it was really good. Satisfying.
I was pretty happy with it too, and I don't know how online you are about this, Emily, but the internet is up in arms. The
Oh, of
internet is
course.
really up
That's
in
why
arms.
I'm not online, Laurie.
I had There were some things I wasn't thrilled with, but overall, I was in my feels, and I came to the realization that I much prefer reading online commentary when I'm disappointed with something and I need to feel validated. I need to see that other
Yeah.
people are also like, wait, this didn't make sense. This wasn't satisfying. This was right. And I found with this, I was like so emotionally caught up that I'd finish the episode and not be like, I need to go online and be like, wow, I need to just sit with my feelings for a moment and cry a little and like come down from that a bit. And then when I would like half an hour later open up my phone and see everyone just complaining about every single thing, I was like, I mostly liked it. I did.
Yeah.
I felt that a lot of it was really emotionally satisfying. I didn't love everything. I think especially the finale for me, which overall I liked some things about, but I just didn't like that the military just kind of like disappeared. I thought we were going to get like a whole like, okay, great, they defeated Vecna, and now we have to take down the real monsters, our humans, the ones who started all of this with their horrible experiments. So that part
Fizzled.
disappointed me. But like, Escape from Kamazotz was probably my favorite episode. Like watching Max run up that hill again. Like I was mostly really into it.
Don't you think they
I
could
enjoyed
have
it.
made some really bad decisions about what to do with it? And they didn't. Like,
No,
I was
after the
like,
ending of Game of Thrones, I was like, "What? What are you talking about?"
Or
And this, I was
lost, you
scared for
know?
that.
Yeah, I didn't want it to all be a dream. I
And
didn't want
crying.
it to be
Oh,
fake. I
Lord.
didn't
All the
want
people
dead
saying
people
it's a
to come
D&D
back.
game.
I
Did
didn't
everyone
want
want
that.
everything to be a D&D game? Come on. What a
I mean, it
cheap
kind
way
of
out it would have
was.
been.
Wasn't part of a D&D like kind of strategy, like part of the maneuver that they.
But people were saying like, "Oh, it was literally going to be the whole time. It was just Mike in his basement playing
Oh, now
D&D
that
and the
would have
whole thing wasn't
disappointed.
real." I was like, "What
That would
is
have
this, the
really disappointed
Bob
me.
Newhart show?"
Yeah, like
You
in
like
that.
that older reference, guys?
I
Nice.
will say maybe one thing, and we can come back to this in terms of a comparison to Harry Potter, but I find the villain to be maybe just a little dumb. I
As
don't
in
know.
Vecna?
Yeah. I mean, maybe he's just a little dumb
Yeah,
in my
who needs to
taste.
be smart when you are really powerful like that?
Isn't Voldemort a little
Well,
dumb? Well,
isn't
that's
Voldemort a
exactly it.
little
And I mean,
dumb?
that's a really good parallel to Harry Potter. There was also that kind of just sinking disappointment that the villain maybe isn't just a little bit smarter and less on the nose, you know?
And it comes from overconfidence, don't you think? I mean, I
Oh,
think
for
that's
sure.
part of the, oh, we got some really dumb villains in real life going on right
But
now,
I also
so.
think, I wouldn't just say
Yes.
dumb. I would say there is also, maybe this is skipping ahead a little bit, ways that Vecna and Voldemort are similar. I think the sympathetic child, both of them having been a sympathetic child, Will seeing himself in Henry, I think is very similar to Harry having learned about Voldemort's past, about Tom Riddle, and saying, this was a kid who maybe did not start out so different from me.
Yeah,
And I think that
absolutely.
parallel was there. But I think also the that doesn't excuse you. A lot of people had said, like, oh, I want to see Henry like actually is helping them and is going to turn back and be good. And I kind of liked where they got on that, like, yes, he might have been a victim at some point, but he has continually chosen for years and years and years to kill and
Yeah.
to use violence.
Right.
And
Yeah.
like, there, it's past the time for saying, like, was he at some point a victim? Maybe, but he's chosen not to resist. He's chosen to pursue.
He is like Voldemort or Tom Riddle. He's given an opportunity to repent and he doubles down on the way he is. And I was like, that was very Harry Potter moment. I thought in the duel, even it's the
Yeah.
same kind of setup. And it just, I mean, I think it sort of shows you that some people, sometimes people go too far to reach redemption. Although not everybody in the series had that. So I agree, Laurie, that I also had hoped there would be more like comeuppance for the military thing. And in fact, I said to my husband, I was like, oh, and now we're gonna take down,
Linda Hamilton,
Linda Hamilton,
waste. She
yes,
was
and all that.
wasted.
She's so good, and it was like, but they didn't give her depth, and I didn't really have a sense
Yeah.
of, I wish there had been something more there, but ultimately it wasn't really about that, and that's okay. And I liked the epilogue, but I kind of like that kind of thing. It felt like it helped a kind of way to understand the whole story. And I was mostly not disappointed. I thought it was all doing its job, and I thought it was consistent. It didn't pull the carpet out from under you. It didn't suddenly become something it had not started out to be. I
Yeah.
thought it was really consistent. It had its story it was telling, and it basically did it, and it did it in a way that there were some surprises for me and some things I definitely didn't anticipate, and I was along for the ride.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, what did people not like about it?
Everything.
Oh, okay.
I mean, people
Again.
are losing their minds. People are like, the Duffers are the worst people on the planet, even though they like
Ah.
wrote 4 seasons that you loved. People are calling everything a plot hole that I think is just you have to expect that some stuff gets explained off screen. People saying it's a plot hole that Max graduated high school. You think she didn't go to summer school? You think they didn't like go easy on her and say, we'll give you your degree because you were in a coma?
Max is very smart.
I don't think that's a plot hole. I think that's like they made sure she could graduate between summer school, extra classes, extra credit.
Are we
and
supposed
like some
to see
lenience.
That? How boring would that
yeah,
be to
I'm
explain
like,
that?
We
to
already
yeah,
said
right.
the epilogue was kind of long. I mean, there's a lot of chatter, and this I do kind of agree with about Elle having to sacrifice herself again when she is like an abused child. She's not just like a magical creature or something who like has to go away with childhood. She is like an actual abused real person. So I very much do like to think that she made it out because I feel like kind of repeating her death again after season one would be very, very sad.
I liked how it went into storytelling at the end when they were doing their last D&D game. I thought that was really poignant, actually, the way that Mike was doing that and trying to tell what he thought was his version of her story. And I'm just going to tell you what my thinking of it is. You know, a lot of what they're talking about are real issues that teenagers are grappling with all the time and having to figure out how to deal with it, maybe just with a friend group, not necessarily always well connected with their parents. And I sort of felt as though it was a little bit like suicide and trying to figure out how to deal with somebody who either ran away or who committed suicide, and that that's what they're grappling with. And I thought, even though that's just kind of a metaphor within it, I thought that was something that I would guess that a lot of people would be able to relate to, even if they don't put that word and, you know, exactly on it. I just thought that that was a really like a brave choice to actually deal with that in a way that I think a lot of kids have to deal with, you know, the loss of one of their friends for some reason like that.
And I loved the way, and you're going to think I'm not a real fan, but I cannot remember his name. The guy that was the head of the Hellfire Club who died.
Eddie Munson. Put some respect on that murder. So many people wanted him to come back. You're going to piss people off.
No. I did love, though, the way that they're still dealing with that in this season. You know, they're big time still dealing with Eddie Munson. I thought that it was a really nice service to fans, because I know Eddie Munson had a lot of fans. And I also thought that it was a true portrayal of the characters and what they would be going through, that Dustin would still be really just not over, you know, this death, and that would be affecting his other relationships.
And look, death is a real thing, and people don't come back. And I think that's something that the Harry Potter universe deals with some, although except for Harry. but the idea that death is death. I was really worried, like, about Barb. Man, I'm super angry about Barb. That was awful. Nancy was a horrible friend.
Okay, but Nancy's carried that guilt with her for years. Go easy on Nancy.
So, no, that's right. But I feel like that's all right. That's, you can kind of see that. You see it working out and everything. And I think that some of that is what it is to grow up, you know, as you sort of, everybody's, you know, making their mistakes. And yeah, so I didn't want any of those characters to be actually alive. I thought that would have been cheap.
People complained that none of the major characters, none of the main characters died this season. I was like, what do you want? You want everyone to die? Why do you want
this? They do.
Some people are nihilists.
It's like the
that.
Same way people are like, Ron, like they wanted Ron to die in Harry Potter. And I was like, you leave Ron alone. Partially because I always think like Harry would never recover if Ron died. As it is with Fred, I get sad. I've probably said this before on this podcast. I get sad thinking about like the future moments in the Weasley family and like Fred not being there. And so like I thinking about like who could die from this. I was just like, all of the, like, they couldn't kill Steve when Dustin so many people thought Steve was going to die, and they teased
him. I know. I was worried about Steve, and Steve is one of my favorite characters
in
the whole
way
thing.
They showed Dustin react to Eddie, and I loved that they acknowledged that. I thought that was a great scene of that acknowledgement of, like, why he's particularly, you know, feeling this way towards Steve, of he can't lose someone he has that relationship with again. And so I think I often think about, and this is how I thought about it leading up to the final Harry Potter book too, is like, who could you kill off that it wouldn't irrevocably change the entire dynamic of everyone else forever? Which is why I think Stranger Things has done a lot of like bringing on a new character that we only know for the one season and then kill them, as opposed to someone who like is a core member that it would just like throw everything off kilter, which even like it does a little bit with Elle at the end, even though she was not there like from the very, very beginning, like, with the main four.
She's a main character,
that
time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, oh, she absolutely is.
The danger is for the people who, even if they live, it's not going to be good for them. And that's the problem with Elle. So she's always going to be hunted by these government
They
people.
could find, I'm sorry. This is one thing that I'm like, they had, she, I feel like they had these beautiful conversations with her and Hopper. I think they could have found a solution. And I like to believe that she did, but
I
I wish
think
she'd
they
just like let
did.
her friends know that.
I think they did find a solution. I think
And
she's
Mike
off
took a really
in
long time, I
Patagonia
think,
or
to
wherever she
realize.
is.
I feel like Mike should have thought of this theory
I agree with
earlier.
that. Yeah. But it sounds like we were in agreement. We liked it. We didn't It's not that we didn't have any problems with it, but it did what we wanted it to do. And man, there have been a lot worse series finales than
And
that.
it
Oh,
was,
boy,
I do
yes.
think, compelling and cinematic. Like, I was sitting there every episode like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. I was
It was a
locked
roller
in.
coaster.
I was it was a little, I feel like it was a little slower paced the first two episodes, and then when we got to that third episode, it was just like, whoa, slam bam.
And I liked how the adults were also still in it.
Props for Nancy's mom,
Karen,
That was
the archetypal
shocking. And
Karen. Even Ted came out with the golf
Yeah,
clubs.
that was
And
awesome. Everybody
Dustin's
was in it.
mom was so proud of him.
God, I know, so sweet.
Dustin.
So
I
cute.
love Dustin. She's like,
Yeah.
that's my little rebel.
I just thought they made a lot of good choices in something that was basically a minefield they were navigating, especially with all the things the fans wanted and how much time there had been in between the two seasons. And I
Oh,
thought that they
yeah,
did a
it
good
was
job.
a long time.
And when people are waiting that long, they come up with all these other theories, and you have to kind of, you have to make sure you're true to your own story. And I think that they were. So obviously we are talking about this on our podcast because we see links with Harry Potter, and we've already talked about some of those. For example, the Vecna Voldemort, Henry Tom Riddle connection. But what are some of the links that you all see to Harry Potter?
Immediately, the age of Will, when he is kind of drawn into this magical realm, always reminds me of Harry Potter. And I know it predates Harry Potter, like to have an 11-year-old be, be this kind of like ambassador to this magical world. But it always catches my attention when something strange starts happening to an 11-year-old.
Yeah, and what you said about they're being introduced to another world that you didn't know existed right where you are. I thought that, the upside down world is not exactly the wonderful place that the wizarding world is, but just like ex like much more dangerous right off the bat. It's not unlike the way that there's this connection between the magical and the muggle worlds in Harry Potter, and then you've got this upside down world where things are kind of the same, but kind of different and sinister at the same time.
I think the way that we start at that age and see them grow up and their circle grows, I think is also very reminiscent of Harry Potter. Obviously, the themes in this start out much more adult than Harry Potter did because it's like quite violent and quite scary right off the bat. But having these kids we start seeing at 11 or 12 and go all the way up to 18 and see them get new friends along the way and new allies along the way, that added complexity and these added relationships, and sometimes those relationships breaking down and people having fights. Seeing first relationships as the first romantic relationships reminds me a lot of Harry Potter too. And I think I've seen a lot of young people, I am a young person, but younger people who are close in age to those characters who see it kind of as their Harry Potter, of like they were 12 to 14 when the show started and like in college by the time it ended. The structure is somewhat reminiscent of Harry Potter too, even though they take place in much shorter periods of time. Usually, most of these seasons take place only within a few days or a week. But we are still seeing, I think, that development through different stages of their lives.
Yeah, and it's
Although,
episodic. Like the books are their own little arcs. Each season on Stranger Things is its own arc, but within the larger series. And even there's like that the fourth season where they're kind of wandering around in the desert. I felt like there was some similar. So I thought the structure of it, exactly as you were saying, I agree that it follows a bit of a similar pattern.
like, I still feel a bit uncomfortable having my kid watch Stranger Things just because of the gore, the violent gore. He assures me it would be fine. But yeah, but I'm just like, oof, it's just a little,
No, and
just
the
too.
demonic possession and the mental health stuff,
Yeah.
I think that's tough.
Yeah. So I'm like, I would be concerned. Even the first season, a 12-year-old, 11 or 12-year-old watching this, is to me, it's like, ooh, no. And that's, I always get a little squeamish. And I was like this with the Fantastic Beasts movie, the first one, where you have children in the film, but it's really not appropriate for children, you know. Or you have for Fantastic Beasts, it was the cute animals, you know, the adorable animals, and then you know you had this kind of you know the storyline about this young man being sort of groomed for abuse and groomed for evil purposes. So I don't know, but I do agree with everything you said, Lori. I just as a mom, I'm kind of like.
I do sometimes hear of young kids watching this show, and I'm like, what? Oh my God, it's like too scary for me. And I'm like, again, they're sex, they're drugs, they're some of it's quite adult
Oh,
material.
that first
But
season,
also, I was thinking about how in season five, they're just killing a lot of people. Like Nancy is straight up shooting humans. She like killed a bunch of soldiers probably. And then I
Sure
was
did.
discussing that with a friend. I'm like, wow, we saw them killing a lot of people, like our heroes killing people this time around. And my friend pointed out Eleven was snapping necks in season one. And I was like, oh God, yeah, wow, she was, wasn't she? But I remember with season four, they started off with the snapping limbs, eye sockets, Vecna stuff. And I sent episodes one, two, and three. I was sending texts to my friend going, oh my God, why do I watch this show? Oh, this is so disgusting. This is way too much body horror for me. This is nasty. Why do I do this? And then we got up to episode four, Dear Billy, running up that hill. And I texted her, this is why I watch this show. Because they get me with this, because I'm sitting there going, oh God, stop snapping the limbs, leave their eyes alone. And then we get up to like, if I only could, I'd make a deal with God. And I'm like, yes, Max, run! And suddenly I'm all in.
I still put that song on. Like, if I have just a short walk someplace and I just need an up, you know, I just need some sort of a boost, I'll put that song on.
I do think that the heavy themes of there is, you know, evil around us and it is actually trying to bring us into its web, I think is something that we can see between both Stranger Things and Harry Potter. And the fact that you've got people who are kind of living without realizing it, and then you've got these people who are like, ah, oh, there's some really bad stuff happening, and we have to basically try to choose a side and amid the blindness of other people to the evil around. I feel like that's a similar kind of vibe in the two series. And of course, I think that there are all these suggestions about authoritarian governments, you know, and governments becoming the evil that they say they're fighting against.
The deep state.
You know, militarism, I think in those cases too, and the way that children are maybe brought in those kinds of systems, I think
Children being used, right? Think about the way the ministry wants to use Harry and does not protect him, and how Elle is used. And, you know,
And her
it's,
mother and
oh.
yeah, countless other pregnant women.
Yeah, I mean, the government are never the good guys in Stranger Things. Like from the beginning, we know government bad guys. That takes a little longer to get to that in Harry Potter, I think, of having that disillusionment. And I guess in general, if we also just think about when you're talking about evil and good, the nature of magic or the supernatural in these, for Harry initially at least, it is a positive thing. Wow, magic is exciting, but like there's also this dark stuff. There's dark magic, and that's also how his, like, yes, his parents are magical, but magic also killed them. And Stranger Things, a lot of it is monsters are real, but as kids who love Dungeons and Dragons, there's something exciting about that. And in addition to finding out, oh no, our friend's been abducted by a monster, there's also, wow, we met this new friend who's like a superhero. And so we get that too, of like there's the enchantment and excitement while also being mixed with the horror of like, you don't want this to be real because it's scary, but maybe another part of it is kind of cool.
I love the idea also that it's friendship and gangs of friends who come together to defeat evil, and that, you know, one of them can't do it. They need each other. And I feel like it's part of the D&D culture that they bring to that as they're making their plans, but that they all kind of understand that each one has their particular strengths, and they don't always get along with each other, but they are banding together, and they have these bonds of friendship that are helping them in their, quest for the good. And I think that's a definite theme in both of them. So one of the other things that I had noticed was, of course, I mentioned like being possessed by evil, and I thought in the last season especially, the way that Holly was befriended by Henry, and then he used that as a way to basically take over her mind, I felt was very Tom Riddle's Diary and Jenny Weasley in the Chamber of Secrets. So I felt like Vecna is to Holly as Voldemort slash Tom Riddle is to Jenny, because I thought it was similar and similar kind of, trying to figure out how do you come out of having had evil be a part of your mind like that. And she has a hard time with it, and the other kids certainly do as well. And I thought that was very, very real in terms of, I think especially like there's so many things that control our minds these days, and seeing that as a vulnerability for children especially.
I just have to take this moment to just give a shout out to Dipshit Derek
Oh, I loved
because
him.
I loved
I
Dipshit
think
Derek.
you mean delightful, Derek.
Delightful Derek, but no, in this moment
Suck
we need
my
Dipshit Derek.
I know he was great when he. I know. I love,
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
love they didn't just make him totally change himself, but recognize some of the badass parts of even that really annoying part of his personality that could be used for good.
Yes, I loved that. I thought he acted the whole thing really well. You could see the kind of transformation going on in him. He just needed some purpose, you know. He just really needed fighting monsters. That'll do it. Yeah, he was great. And that's just classic Stranger Things to bring in this brand new character at the last minute who is nothing like any of the other characters we've met before and yet who really contributes really meaningfully to both the plot and to the character development of the people around him and his own character arc. It was really good. I've been using the word dipshit so much more often now to refer to a specific kind of obtuse behavior.
The danger is they love to kill those kinds of characters. So
Yep.
I was like, they can't do this to our guy, Derek. He's too young.
They took a character that, is kind of a bully and is also potentially a subject of bullying, and they ended up having a lot of respect for that character in a way that I think in the stereotype doesn't usually allow. And I like that. I like that. I agree.
Is his family still in the barn?
I wondered that too. And
Just
that's a plot hole that I know. I
do.
said that to my husband at the end. I was like, so did anybody ever like get those people off? They had their heads covered and they were tied up.
Also, their house is destroyed. So hope they're okay. I mean, Derek seems okay at the end, so I feel like probably it's not like his whole family is dead, right? I think he's all right. Talking about Vecna and the kids he takes also, I mean, we have to talk about Will in this season
Yeah.
and how much comparison was made with, I mean, in that sorcerer episode, that end where he finally, controlled he Vecna the Demogorgons. I was waiting for him, like that whole episode, I mean, the whole season really, I was like, he's gonna pull out some powers, right? Like they keep hinting at it. But I did not realize he was gonna specifically Vecna those Demogorgons, and snap some limbs. That was epic. That was awesome. But so many people were making the comparison to Harry Potter of the getting into Vecna's mind and the hive
Right.
mind, which shows can both be helpful but potentially used to manipulate him too and to capitalize on his fears. And I feel like there was a lot of echoing of Order of the Phoenix in this and what that mind connection can maybe give helpful insight and can be used against someone, but also could make you vulnerable to attack. And Harry has to learn how to block that out or by the seventh book use it to his advantage because it's a dangerous connection. And I think
Yeah, I feel
especially
like.
the idea that he can get some of Vecna's powers is very much like Harry as a Horcrux, right? Harry can only speak Parseltongue because Voldemort can, and he can't anymore. So I'm also guessing Will's not going to have powers at the end of this anymore because Vecna's gone. That connection's gone.
Right. Yeah, I would imagine that is true. And I also was struck by, and maybe, Stranger Things didn't have the luxury of a couple more season arcs to explore this, but I feel like Will managed it a lot better than Harry. It took Harry a while,
Yeah, it took
All
him
that
a while
stuff
to
with
figure out
Snape
what
just
was
drive me
happening,
nuts.
This takes place over more time, though, right? The like a
Yeah.
book is an entire year, and Will had like 4 days.
So true. So true.
I'll let him have it.
Give Harry the pass.
Yeah, I think though that that kind of important idea of your window into evil can also be, when a way that you could become evil. And we talked about that a little bit before with understanding that maybe Will and Henry had some similarities as children in what they were like, and that was what drew Henry to Will, and that then he uses him and tries to use him in a not a dissimilar way to a Horcrux. But then that he is ultimately defeated. And I did think that the duel at the end was very reminiscent of what happened between Harry and Voldemort, except that it was not one-on-one. Again, it was more the gang of kids together, getting together to have a like a little combination defeat. But Joyce gets her moment, her not my son, you bitch, or whatever. You want to translate Molly
Yeah.
Weasley's?
Well,
Oh my.
Karen Wheeler also had very much a
That's
not my
right.
daughter, you bitch
Oh,
moment. Motherly
Karen.
love, very
Yeah.
prominent here. But I also think that at least the way that a different person destroyed every Horcrux in Harry Potter, it's more spread out than like this one battle where everyone's playing a part.
Right.
But we do see all these characters fight in the Battle of Hogwarts too. So I do think there is something similar there. Also, what you say about the similarities between Will and Vecna too make me think about Voldemort choosing Harry for the
Right.
prophecy when it could have been Neville, because he chose the one who was more similar to him, who was not pure blood. Maybe there's an echo there too of Henry going after a kid in which he sees some of himself.
Another thing that I think is true in both cases. I don't know if it's like it's not exactly kind of direct motif or something, but that the children in both stories, as they mature, they get to understand that the adults in their lives are also dealing with wounds and vulnerabilities and things that are hard for them, and that they're not supposed to be, perfect parents. I mean, and the Wheelers are like they're supposed to be like perfect 80s parents, and by the end you can see like, whoa, stuff's really not that great at
She
the Wheeler
pours a lot of
household.
wine on the problem. She really does.
But then also I think especially with Joyce as a single parent and all the stuff that Hopper is dealing with, and then in the Harry Potter world, Harry has to understand Sirius, and he has to come to terms with his own father's flaws, and then Dumbledore and trying to figure out, like how do I connect myself with people who aren't maybe even more morally perfect or morally pure. And I think that the Stranger Things universe is also very aware that the adults are, they're just grown up kids, and they've also got problems they're dealing with.
I think the flow of information between children and adults becomes important in season
Yeah.
five too. I mean, it was important earlier, but I think especially Nancy mentions it after their parents are attacked. Maybe Mike does too, about they never told their parents all the stuff that was going on, which also meant their parents didn't have an opportunity to protect them,
Right.
to protect them or themselves. They kept everything a secret, and it was like, well, now they got attacked and they had no idea what was going on. They didn't know there are monsters that they need to be on the lookout for. Karen didn't believe Holly while she was freaking out until she realized there was blood on her head. And I think that guilt of like, God, maybe we should have been more open about what was going on, happens in both directions, both of like, should they have told their parents? But then when Joyce is finding out information, and Hopper, like in earlier seasons, there's this idea of like, who gets to know what privileged information and what Harry doesn't, says is a secret from Dumbledore and he's not supposed to tell anyone else, but what Dumbledore doesn't tell him. The youth can do a lot themselves, like when Nancy is doing all her own investigative reporting that other people won't get done. But sometimes the flow of information can make everyone stronger if everyone actually talks to each other and communicates and says what they need.
Yeah, think about
Maybe
how,
Mike should have cast Obliviate on his parents and sent them out of the country, or
think
maybe
about
Nancy.
how Molly Weasley and Sirius have that argument about what Harry needs to know, and Molly is trying to protect him and keep him a child, and Sirius is like, he's in it. And I think that I see a lot of that in Hopper. He's trying to figure out how much do I try to protect Elle, and how much do I try to like just train her so that she can protect herself. And that's a lot of, I think, what that final season is kind of wrestling with as she's, growing up and becoming independent and like spreading her wings maybe at the end.
I love their relationship.
And I also see a ton of Hermione Granger in Nancy Wheeler, and just her just constant, consistent competence in everything she puts her hand to, and her constantly having, not just the information, but then just also the guts to pull it off,
She
Although
does
I
some
will
real dumb
say,
stuff though. Like, why'd she fire that gun at the like the weird
at the exotic
space
matter. And
space
also, she
thing?
kills a lot of people. There
Yeah.
are a lot
Well, I'm
of
not
female
saying,
soldiers. I will say this show is less concerned with, the moral pureness, the moral purity perhaps of its characters, and not getting their hands dirty. Their hands are dirty.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's part of why it's off limits until my son's a little older. But
Do you all see other differences or divergences that you think are, significant in these two?
I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to that they're kind of meant for different age groups, right? I think even though they deal with people of similar ages, for one thing, the main character in Harry Potter is always his age. We are always following him. And the main characters in Stranger Things have always, from season one, been different ages. We have the plot with Mike and Co. We have the plot with Nancy and Co. We have the plot with Joyce and Co. Like there are Joyce and Hopper, there are different aspects here. It's very intergenerational as a show, in a way that I think it's just more adult. And I think a lot of the difference is about how dark it is, how violent it is. It's like view of humanity or human nature maybe is going to be a lot different from something that's written initially for like 11-year-olds.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you think that it's a more cynical or pessimistic series, Stranger Things, than Harry Potter?
Yes.
Yeah. As I said before, like the magic is almost all dark. Even Elle's powers, which are like, oh, that's cool, she has powers. It's because she was experimented on.
Yeah, and it's always consequential for her with this, like, I'm like,
The
where's that blood
nosebleed
coming
every
from?
single
What is
time.
this?
Like,
Your brain bleeding? Quit
even when
it.
she does fun stuff, even when like they're doing Dustin's toys when he comes back at the beginning of season three from summer camp, even that little stuff makes her nosebleed. Like
Exactly.
that's dark.
Exactly. That's not a happy power. That's not just a purely
And
good.
even genre, like Stranger Things is not really fantasy. It's like horror sci-fi. Yeah.
I don't know. The D&D stuff, I think, brings in the fantasy and the demigorgons and all that kind of stuff. So,
There's a lot of crossover there. But in the end, there's kind of a scientific explanation for her powers. Am I right?
yeah, I mean, for all of it, right? It's all tied to these
These science
experiments
experiments.
and
So it's not really
yeah.
magic in that same way.
And alternate dimensions.
Yeah, I guess with Will, it's his connection with Vecna. So that's science, it's science fiction horror, but also you do have this kind of like psychological speculative narrative going on in it, which I
Yeah.
do think you see in a lot of, especially mid-20th century science fiction. You have this like, what is possible with the human brain? What powers might develop?
This is also, I think, so tied to, and maybe this is, I mean, I was gonna say it's different from Harry Potter, but maybe it's not that different. I'm sure, Katie, as a historian, you will have thoughts on this, how tied to history it is, because so much of what happens in Stranger Things is about it being the Cold War. And if you get into stuff that's like, I don't know if you guys have seen the play. I have
Oh,
Stranger
I
Things: The First
wanted
Shadow.
to.
I saw it
No.
in London, which I have mixed feelings about it, and how
What
they
play?
tried to. There's a Stranger Things play.
I didn't know
Yeah, tell
that.
us about the plot. Tell us about the
Okay,
plot, because I don't
so
know.
spoilers, vaguely, the plot is so that little snippet we got of high school when Max is going through Henry's memories, that is what the play is. The play is Henry
Oh.
Creel, at Hawkins High School. With basically all of the parent characters, which we can talk about how,
Yeah.
like, oh, everyone happened to be exactly the same age and they were at the same time and everyone was from the. Okay. And that he was in a play that Joyce directed, and how he was taken advantage of by Brenner and how he. Which also, like, I feel like there was a lot of retconning, like, how old was he supposed to have been when Brenner took him away and he did all the stuff to his parents
And
and
why is
sister?
McGonagall here? Sorry.
Kind of, yes. And then it's like, I don't think it's right to have something that you're saying is going to hold keys to the next season only be available to a small group of people who have the access to it. So I have a lot of feelings on that. And then they ended up not really explaining most of it in the show, which feels fine and if it doesn't actually make a difference and it just gives you like a little bit of Easter egg additional stuff. But one of the things that I think is relevant from it is that it explains how all of these experiments and everything went back to World War II era, if I'm remembering this correctly. And so I feel that it roots it even more in history, how this is all tied to, international conflict and governments trying to be competitive with each other.
This is all probably related to recent reading on my part. I've just finished a book on by Timothy Egan called A Fever in the Heartland, about the Ku Klux Klan and their northern activities in their revival in the 20s. And what a firm, not just a firm grip, but what dominance they had over the state of Indiana. And their dominance was not just among kind of the general population who it was all graft. I mean, it was all like, a bunch of grifters selling these memberships to the KKK and then taking a percentage of the profit off of both the membership and the sale of the robes, right? So there were people at the top that were just getting so rich selling membership into this club that was all about hatred, right? That was just all about hating
And then
blacks and
you want
Catholics
your
and
hatred
Jews.
paraphernalia, so it's
Right,
another
exactly.
money-making
You gotta have your
opportunity.
outfit. And then they were kind of selling themselves on these like really homespun values, this morality and everything. And by the end of the 20s, when that all came crashing down, because some of their highest members were found to be rapists and sadists and horrible, polygamists, things like that. It all came crashing down. But if the Duffer, I don't get into kind of the authorial intent or whatever, but I don't know if the Duffer brothers have a history in Indiana or if that choice of Indiana was an intentional choice to set this sort of, metaphor of this world underneath. Because of course the KKK was the invisible empire, right? It was the invisible, it was like you don't talk about it, but they have actually control of the state government. They put the governor in place in the mid-1920s. And so it is kind of interesting if you're thinking about Stranger Things on that kind of a level as sort of this metaphor for this invisible canker on the this very mundane, otherwise mundane kind of wholesome world. I don't know. I'm just kind of seeing some new possibilities there.
Yeah, I think that's very tantalizing. I always feel this way about Harry Potter too, and that when you root something in history, and it's the story rooted in history, but then it's also the themes that you're bringing out are ones that come that stem from World War II era or some other era, that I think what you do is you emphasize the point that I think is the point of the Harry Potter series and maybe of Stranger Things too, that these things never go away completely, and you're always having to fight them again in new generations, maybe in new forms. But that there's no final victory over these monstrous, authoritarian, cruel, but also very empowered forces.
That, especially for me, stood out with Elle's supposed decision to sacrifice herself because it was the only way to end this. I found that not convincing because my attitude is you think that would make them stop because you're not here anymore. You think they wouldn't try some other experiment? Like, this did not all start just with Henry. Like, there, and maybe that you kind of need the play to explain, but they show it a little bit in the cave that Henry like discovered something else, that they'll keep doing crazy experiments and trying to do something else. And so much of this is inspired by like these real like mind control experiments like MK Ultra that. That's one reason it's like, shouldn't Elle with her superpowers and her friends like be there to stop these people who would continue to do this kind of stuff no matter what? Because it's like, oh, they'll just stop and be like, well, the girl got away. I guess we're done doing our crazy experiments now. No, they're going to do some other crazy experiment. That's why we need people like Elle and gang around for next time they pull some, dangerous and illegal stuff.
I find that, the Indiana KKK history part of that very interesting.
Oh, and I just thought of something too. The prosecutor who brought down the Northern KKK leader
D.C. Stevenson was his, the guy. He was a rapist, a sexual predator, and the guy who brought him down, the prosecutor, was Will Remy. Mm. I could go on.
Let's, yeah. Yeah. Oh, very interesting.
I need to workshop this.
Yeah, for sure.
You heard it here first.
Okay, we've talked some about some of the complaints about the series finale, and one of the things that was a complaint, especially about this season, but I think is also could be applied to other seasons as well, is that there was a lot of emotional sharing, and that it got in the way of the action. And so I'm just going to throw this out there, like not even thinking about whether like we totally agree with that or not, but what's the reason why you would have emotion like that in fantasy slash horror? And why would Stranger Things and Harry Potter include that? How should that balance with the action of the plot?
I have very strong feelings on this because I saw so many people complaining about this. And while I agree that maybe some of these scenes were a little long, you could have tightened it up, I think that the idea that, oh, they're standing there talking instead of fighting is how you fight. The talking is part of the fighting. And this was a lot of my master's dissertation, which was about sword versus sorcery, violence and fantasy in Harry Potter, as well as in medieval literature, and how knights go on quests, and sometimes a part of the quest is a dream quest and a vision quest, and how magic is essential and emotional growth is essential in order to defeat something. It's not just fighting a battle with a sword or a wand. So I felt that that was very poignant here, that some of these scenes needed to happen. So the biggest one that people complained about is Will's coming out scene. Do I think there were too many people in that who did not need to be there? Yes. Why was Murray there? He had no reason to be there. But I thought the fact of everyone's like, oh, we all already know he's gay. He doesn't need to say it. Like, okay, I feel like it is very significant for a lot of people, especially in that time, to say it out loud.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And very dangerous.
Very dangerous.
And
I
think
very brave.
He needed to do that in order. And he explained pretty clearly to me he needed to do that in order to be able to fight Vecna, because it scared him, because it was a vulnerability for him. Mm-hmm. So that emotional work is actual emotional work is manifested in physical results when he is able to start fighting back more.
It serves
Vecna.
The plot. I mean, just
it does
open and shut. It serves the plot, in
it's
my
necessary.
Opinion. And to be honest, I feel the same way about it that I feel about her J.K. Rowling's revelation that Dumbledore's gay. I mean, she didn't have it in the books, and I understand why she didn't have it in the books, and that's probably for the best. At the same time, I don't think it's like, well, that's the last thing I need to know. Okay, that maybe is your opinion, but it actually does serve the plot. You know, it kind of tells us more about the relationship between this character and the villain and why things went the way they did, you know? And so I do, but I think in this case, it is even more obvious that it serves the plot. And that he does need to unburden himself of this before he faces the ultimate, showdown.
And the other big scene, the coming out one, I think was the biggest one. The other one that people complained about was Max and Holly when they need to escape from Camazotz. And the joke keeps being, and now they even got like the actors making the joke on like late night TV and stuff. It's like, we can't take care. Everything becomes meme to the point, like we take away all the meaning from it because, oh, one person made a joke about it on the internet. Now the rest of us all have to make the same joke instead of just, you know, appreciating it and having an emotional experience, which is, oh, they did an entire podcast episode, Max and Holly, when they said they had to get out of there. Oh, we have to run. Oh, the window might close. Run, girl, run. And they're sitting there having an entire podcast episode. For one thing, Max explains, you know what? I don't actually need the music. Like I can open the window. You can open the window. There are other ways to do this. And we're not on a time. She basically explained we're not on that same time crunch now because we've discovered the music is not the essential thing. It was a little frustrating the first time they showed her just standing there. Sure. But it's like she's been in Henry's brain for months and months and like does not have her wits about her and is surprised at what she's seeing. Cut the girl some slack. I don't get how anyone's watching that scene. And yes, for a moment I was like, okay, run. But I was so taken away by all the beautiful things she was saying to Holly. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was such a gorgeous and important scene because it wasn't just, oh, well, this is really touching. It's also she is explaining how you escape. She is explaining, which ends up being important, again, like that it's about anchoring yourself, that this emotional growth is the way out. disconnecting it from one specific song or person even, and connecting it just to what grounds you. And to me, again, it was beautiful and it was necessary.
I don't know if I'm right about this, but I kind of wonder, TV and cinema have really kind of swapped places in a sense, in terms of like mainstream culture and what people are really watching and like feeling passionate about. And I really think that we have confused expectations for, but this is television. And like, sure, if that scene with Will coming out of the closet to all of his best people, if that goes on a little long, or if this conversation between Holly and Max goes on a little long, guys, that's just television, you know? And honestly, I'm refreshed by that because I'm on my couch. I'm relaxed, you know, it's not sticky under my feet. I don't want to get out of there as quickly as possible, you know, for fear that some stranger is going to cough on me. So like,
I was not relaxed when I was watching Stranger Things.
But it's my seat, right? It's my seat in my house with my smells and my cat, you know? So I just think people have, when a product is so cinematic, because TV is just so cinematic now, that I think people have trouble kind of in the moment, like letting it be television rather than expecting the same things that they expect with cinema.
People just want action constantly, which again, we think about Harry Potter primarily as a book series, then as a movie. And so there's a lot of emotional exploration you don't necessarily get in the movies that is covered in narration.
Yes.
But I will also say that I think we've talked about before, one of the strongest points of the Order of the Phoenix movie, generally agreed upon, is the expansion of Harry fighting the possession and seeing all those beautiful memories that help pull him out of it when it's much briefer in the book. That was one example of, oh, let's see all this, what's helping him fight back. And I think in Harry Potter, we get between like the Patronus and the way Harry uses the people he loves and happiness to literally fight Dementors, to literally fight Voldemort. That's what I see a lot of these emotions being here too.
Yeah.
I also say another scene that people seem to have problems with that I like too is I thought Jonathan and Nancy, the breakup, quote unquote, was it a breakup? No one seems to understand. It seemed pretty clearly, at least a for now breakup. I found that to be a really beautifully done scene. And again, like I thought it was, if not physically important, I thought it was very well done when the ring went flying and you hear the ring and it's, wait, oh my God. Because I was starting to get worried for them a little bit. My favorite moments of this season were all talking moments. They were not action moments. There was some great action too, but I think what I find so compelling about Harry Potter, about a lot of things, is really the characters and the emotion and the way that those things are how you fight evil, are how you accomplish your goals.
So basically book 6, which is mostly talking.
I think book 3 and 5 to some extent, because that's what Dylan Patronus. I mean,
book 6 is like one of my favorite books. Yeah, but it's a lot of talking.
To me, the key is, like, I don't care about characters who are just doing action. And this is one of the problems I have with some of the Marvel stuff is like, and it's all plot and I can't like, but when you know the characters and you have a sense of, oh, this person's like struggled with some things and like I can relate. And then you see the connections and the friendships are messy and real. And it gives you a sense of why it matters. And it makes you care about the action more. You know, in a book, you can have all of this stuff happening and you can see what's happening in the interiors of characters because of the narration. But when you're in a movie or when you're with a television series, they have to put all that stuff out there and they don't want you to lose the sense of urgency. And so they say it's 5 seconds till the end of the world. And now we're going to have a 3-minute conversation about our feelings. And so, but you're feeling urgent that whole time. And I think it actually intensifies the experience of the action as a result. I actually think, I agree, we're all in agreement here. Very important. So what do we think about the epilogues in the two stories? Because both Harry Potter and Stranger Things end with the epilogues that are kind of tying things up that happen some distance. With Harry Potter, it's 17 years later, and with Stranger Things, it's 18 months later.
liked it. It didn't go on too long. I love Dustin's speech, and
it was, I mean, I think epilogues in general are like a little indulgent, you know,
yeah.
But they're there to satisfy. And I think
you had to have an epilogue for Stranger Things for sure.
You did. You absolutely did. And the real kernel of it for me was that revelation about Elle, possibly being, you know, on the loose. And so that was why it was there. But I also, I liked, you know, I mean, the D&D game and the putting the folders back on the shell, you know, that was very sweet. Also a little indulgent, and that's okay. That's okay. I'm here for it. Again, it's TV. Do I want it to end? No. So give me more.
I like the amount of time that they jumped. I thought it was a good amount. I still wish there had been like a little more right then, but jumping to the end of high school felt appropriate to really have them like going off in different directions. Mm-hmm. It felt like the right jump. Like, I've said a lot about how I never really loved how far they jumped ahead in Harry Potter and showing everyone like living basically the same status quo lives with children and government jobs in the future. And so this, I still think, gave them enough room for possibility in the future while showing what paths people are on. I actually didn't love the Dustin speech. Well, I loved some parts of the Dustin speech. I loved the way he honored Eddie. But some parts of it to me felt like we missed something. All his stuff about like, oh, we all came together and I became friends with people I never would have been friends with. I was like, the last time we saw you, you got beat up by a bunch of these people, like really badly. So I don't know where that came from about acting like you all came together. You made one new friend and it was Steve. Wait, I also just want to point out, I suddenly realized we have not said the name Robin once this episode.
Yeah, I know.
And I just want to give her her flowers because she was the person Will needed.
Yeah.
And she gave that beautiful speech that brought the powers out of him. And I think she has some Luna Lovegood vibes, actually.
Oh, yes.
I think there's some Luna. She's a little kooky.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
She's a little
on
weird.
The outs.
She's Scoops Ahoy.
But the way she said things to Will, where he kind of seems to think she's like a little kooky and weird, and he doesn't know her all that well, but she's the person telling him what he needs to hear, did feel to me a lot like Harry getting to know Luna and thinking about himself through what she tells him and seeing certain similarities that she's lost a parent. She can see Thestrals. Also, like, is the Squawk like the Quibbler? I don't know. It's like it's
I
getting across
that.
The information
yeah.
they need to.
But it sounds like crazy conspiracy theories, you know?
Right.
Yeah, I thought that too. Yes. Great.
But like the stuff she's saying is like getting the information to them about, mm-hmm. you know, for the resistance. But back to epiloguing. Yeah, I mean, I found a lot of it. Maybe went on a little long, but I found a lot of it very touching. The thing that I think it now has led to that also reminds me of Harry Potter is all the conversation about spin-offs. We want more. We want more information. And I think that way lies frustration and disappointment. you know, I think leaving things open-ended can be good. And I think that I think people want every detail filled in. People are like, well, what exactly happened to every single person in those 18 months? And what exactly is going to happen next? And people want more and more filler and stories. And I'm like,
write your fan fiction about that.
It's called your imagination. Mm-hmm. Just take it in. And I say, like, then make something else similar. Make something else that gives similar vibes or similar genre. And I think that.
Don't you think that this is one of the major problems of our day is that people want certainty and they need to be able to live with uncertainty, suspense, and ambiguity? That's life. I thought, you know, if you think of Elle as maybe somebody who runs away and then you don't know what happened to her, you know, and that happens a lot and people don't have any closure and people don't have any sense of what, you know, what happens. And I think in a way, what I liked about the epilogue was that, as you said, Laurie, it doesn't tie up too much, but it shows you kids trying to recover from traumatic events and doing it in ways that are different, unique to them. And I did love the Mike's ending with story and putting it all in a kind of story form that helps us to understand it and to make sense of things that maybe were really hard to wrap their minds around. And also to see a future for themselves in the unfolding of continuing stories, which to me, that's what fantasy is all about. That's the beauty of the whole thing.
Yes, Katie, yes.
Have some like some maturity to see that things can be undecided.
Now that's asking
even the
a
couples
lot.
Too. I realize we also didn't mention like the one couple that seems to have made it to the end, Lucas and Max. I like their relationship felt like, especially in early seasons, just more like regular, like, preteens who got together and then they broke up and then they got back together and they're, you know. Whereas, like, Ellen Mike, from like 11 years old, were like deeply in love or something. And I like the way we saw Lucas and Max. Not that it was necessarily Ron and Hermione ish, but like, definitely more. Will they, won't they? Oh, they're broken up. Will they get back together? They're fighting now. And like, saw that grow into a more adult relationship. You know, as he really like stood by her side quite literally. Mm-hmm. So that was sweet too. I like to see that, like, not everyone got all super neatly tied up. Like, it's still left open-ended.
Yeah,
I
agree.
Because so many people wanted, I was very glad Nancy did not end up with Steve or Jonathan. So many people were on, I hate shipping wars. So many people were on
Nancy
this, and
wasn't
I was like,
gonna end up with either one of them.
Yes,
Nancy.
I was like, Nancy's definitely not ending up with anyone. But it's open. Maybe she will get back together with Jonathan. Like, they're, you know, they're making eyes at each other. Like,
yeah,
who knows? It's
right.
It's
I liked.
There.
I like that too. Even though I was kind of a Nancy and Steve kind of person, because I do love Steve. Steve's a favorite character of mine, but. At the same time, when it was unfolding, I was like, yeah, that's about right. That's about right for her to go off and pursue her own career and her own interests, you know, chasing after justice and the truth and, you know, and for everybody to kind of do their own thing. Yeah.
I thought it was really good that they showed the different age groups dealing with it in different ways 18 months later also. And like you were saying, the generational differences. And then we also see Joyce and Hopper. Like, and they're,
that was nice.
They're what's going on with them. And I liked it. I liked it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And didn't mm-hmm. wrap up too much. All right. So our final question here is about a recent New York Times article by Louise Perry. On January 26, 2026, she wrote an article that it had different titles depending on where you saw it. But the one I read was called "The Harry Potter Generation Needs to Grow Up." And in this, she basically argued that the Harry Potter stories are no longer culturally relevant and that they don't speak to the world view of younger generations and that they are definitely going by the wayside, that they were kind of limited and very time bound. In our discussion, we still see the relevance of the Harry Potter stories. But what did you all think of the argument that she was making there about Harry Potter and how, you know, it's sort of a overly optimistic and glossy world that doesn't resonate with young people now?
The part I found strangest about it was that that's what she says the argument is, but it doesn't seem to be what the article is saying. In that a lot of what I was ready for this to be about, like, oh yeah, Harry Potter is like irrelevant or outdated. But a lot of it was saying Harry Potter's too hopeful. And Harry Potter, like, and that's what doesn't speak to young people, which, like, okay, I guess valid that, you know, the young people are getting more jaded and growing up in a different world that, like, you know, Gen Z and Gen Alpha growing up in a different world than millennials were. But she was saying, you know, are more likely to support political violence and Harry Potter has like a nonviolent message. And I was like, that seems like a good thing that maybe does make it kind of timeless of, you know, fighting a battle against evil and wanting to do so on certain moral terms.
She has feelings. I felt like I was reading something that was very personal, and she was part of the generation, I suppose, that you are also, Lori, in that she grew up with the books coming out and the, you know, the events at the bookstore where the new book was coming out and then the movies coming out and the premieres. And that was a very special time for that particular generation. And I feel as though she had the disillusionment charm like cracked over her head and that she's now feeling, you know, like she's gotten older and more cynical and that what she understood those stories to be in childhood has not really panned out. But I don't actually think that everybody feels that way. And I think it still has relevance, and I can see it in not only students, but in my kids as well. But I also think the metaphors continue, and that it's not just the older generations using the metaphors. She's like, people don't talk about that, and but they sure do in the protests and everything. They're still using these Harry Potter reference points, and I think that she's mistaking her feelings for a whole host of like generational feelings that I did not see any substantiated evidence for. You know, I think when you look at Stranger Things, I think it's just a similar, it's a different way of telling a pretty similar story, but that it doesn't, it's not a reversal. I think it does some things differently, but that I believe it's in keeping with the Harry Potter ideals, and I think kids are going to keep reading them, and adults read them. You know, I think they're not going by the wayside. She does not have a good historical understanding of the waves of popularity of the Lord of the Rings and the Narnia books either. She's like, well, these always are. It's like, no. You don't know. You don't
That's
know.
right.
She's just assuming that they've been pretty consistent in their popularity, and that's not the case at all. So
Yeah.
I think that
Yeah.
was a very special generational experience that will not be replicated, but that it's not the sum total of the relevancy of the books. I'm sorry, that was a big monologue from me, but what do you think, Emily?
Good. I agreed with all of it, and I mean, while I appreciated her dig on people who actually take the Harry Potter books as if they are some kind of a sacred text, I appreciated the little dig she had on that, because I've always found that a bit silly. I did feel like she was putting outlier voices at the center of the conversation, as if everybody has done all this deep thinking and reading about the house elves and are all up in arms and disgusted about the fact that there's this portrayal of happy slaves in the, you know, I don't think that kind of a take on the house elves is driving all these people to name their dog Dobby. I just don't think that that's what's driving that. And yet so many dogs are named Dobby. So, you know, I do think that most people don't think about these things on the same kind of level. And you know, kudos to her for thinking about these things on such a deep level. But I agree. I just try not to speak for my entire generation. It's just dangerous. I mean, there's just more diversity than we can see and that we can even talk about. So I agree. I appreciated the conversation, but I didn't really feel like her take represented the average reader.
I'll also say that she cited Anthony, I might butcher his last name, I'm sorry, Jirzinski, who was a speaker at the Harry Potter Academic Conference. I think my first one, maybe, actually, in 2016, and how he had done a study on the political views of Harry Potter fans, and people who read Harry Potter tended to be more politically tolerant, more opposed to authoritarianism. And it's stuff like that. Then when we talk about all these problematic aspects of Harry Potter, that I always come back to, like the various studies like that that show even if there are bits of Harry Potter that are quote unquote problematic or not as progressive, that the overall messages still really speak to us. And like maybe to bring this back to Stranger Things too, like, oh, is there a lot of violence in Stranger Things and a lot that's really dark about it and a lot that's not morally great? Maybe, but like also at the end of the day, isn't it about friends trying to do the right thing? And I mean, started with friends trying to save their friend.
Yeah, I agree. I think that same idea of tolerance and humanity and doing things and being willing to sacrifice yourself for your friends. I think those are, you know, really pure motives that we can see in both of those stories. And so I think that they will continue.
And timeless ones.
Yeah, timeless. I agree with that. Yeah. And I think it's Harry Potter is time bound for Louise Perry, right? Because it represents a time in her life. And so she's not able to see the ways that maybe it will be internalized by future generations. And hopefully Stranger Things too. I hope Stranger Things persists and that people continue to watch it.
It's though it's set, you know, in the 80s, but it's so of our era as well. And so you got kind of a dual, you got layers going on there, lots of layers.
Yes, indeed. Well, what a great conversation. I knew this would be wonderful. Thank you, Emily and Laurie, for joining me on the podcast today to talk about Stranger Things and Harry Potter.
Thanks. It was super fun.
It's been strange, but stranger things have happened.
All right. So today we're closing with a quote from Book Five, Order of the Phoenix, that I think has a nice double meaning in relation to our topic today. And this comes from the part of the book where Harry has seen Arthur Weasley being attacked by Nagini in the Ministry of Magic, and he goes to Headmaster Albus Dumbledore's office to tell him what he has seen and that he's convinced he's seen something that really happened. Dumbledore asks him a lot of questions about how exactly he saw what happened to Arthur and what perspective he has on the events. And when Harry reveals that he saw through the eyes of the snake, Dumbledore brings out, quote, one of the fragile silver instruments whose function Harry had never known, and taps it with his wand. The instrument tinkled into life at once with rhythmic clinking noises. Tiny puffs of pale green smoke issued from the minuscule silver tube at the top. Dumbledore watched the smoke closely, his brow furrowed, and after a few seconds, the tiny puffs became a steady stream of smoke that thickened and coiled in the air. A serpent's head grew out of the end of it, opening its mouth wide. Harry wondered whether the instrument was confirming his story. He looked eagerly at Dumbledore for a sign that he was right, but Dumbledore did not look up. "Naturally, naturally," murmured Dumbledore, apparently to himself, still observing the stream of smoke without the slightest sign of surprise. "But in essence, divided?" Harry could make neither head nor tail of the question. The smoke serpent, however, split itself instantly into two snakes, both coiling and undulating in the dark air. With a look of grim satisfaction, Dumbledore gave the instrument another gentle tap with his wand. The clinking noise slowed and died, and the smoke serpents grew faint, became a formless haze, and vanished. Until next time, class dismissed. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is produced by Laurie Beckoff and edited by Lan Deer. Our announcer is Sarah Brown. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Ellsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Prinzi, Ashley Shepard, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Ellsburn.